but her voice sounded wistful. It is one of her theories that a woman must never be jealous, never try to hold a man against his will. But I could tell that she hadn't enjoyed seeing someone else bring father to life. Mrs. Cotton's bedroom was lovely. There were lots of flowers and new books lying around and a chaise longue piled with fascinating little cushions. And a wood fire. It must be heaven to have a fire in one's bedroom. The bathroom was unbelievable. The walls were looking glass, and there was a glass table with at least half a dozen bottles of scent and toilet water on it. Americans say perfume instead of scent. Much more correct, really. I don't know why perfume should be considered affected in England. Simon says this bathroom's an outrage on the house, said Mrs. Cotton, but I've no use for antiquity in bathrooms. Isn't it lovely? I said to Rose. Glorious, she said, in an almost tragic voice. I could see she was liking it so much that it really hurt her. When we had tied it up, we went to the long gallery. It stretches the full length of the house, and as it is narrow, it seems even longer than it is. It has three fireplaces, and there were fires in all of them. But it wasn't at all too hot. Rose and I strolled along looking at the pictures and statues and interesting things in glass cases, while Mrs. Cotton talked to Topaz. Mrs. Fox Cotton had disappeared after dinner. I suppose she went off to her own bedroom. We got to the fireplace at the far end of the gallery and stood looking back at the others. We could hear their voices, but not a word of what they were saying, so we felt it was safe to talk. "What sort of a time did you have at dinner?" I asked. She said it had been boring. She didn't like Mr. Fox Cotton, and anyway, he had only been interested in Topaz. So I concentrated on the wonderful food. "What did you and Neil talk about?" "Amongst other things. He said you look very pretty," I told her. "What else?" "About America, mostly. I remembered as much as I could for her, particularly about the ranch in California. I had liked the sound of it." "What? Cows and things?" she said disgustedly. "Is he going back there?" "Oh, it was sold when the father died. But he did say he'd like to have a ranch himself if ever he could afford it." "But aren't they very rich?" "Oh, shut up," I whispered, and took a quick look at Mrs. Cotton. But we were really quite safe. "I don't suppose Neil's rich. And it probably takes all Simon's money to keep this place up. Come on, we'd better go back." As we reached the fireplace in the middle of the gallery, Mrs. Fox Cotton came in. It was the first time I'd had a really good look at her. She's small, not much bigger than I am, with straight black hair done in an enormous knob low on her neck, and a very dark skin. Both skin and hair look greasy to me. Topaz says the modelling of a face is beautiful, and I do see that, but I don't think the modelling would be damaged by a real good wash. She was wearing a clinging dark green dress, so shiny that it looked almost slimy. It made me think of seaweed. Her Christian name, believe it or not, is Leda. Rose and I walked to meet her, but she sat down on a sofa, put her feet up, and opened an old calf-bound book she had brought in with her. "Do you mind?" she said. "I want to finish this before we go back to London tomorrow." "What is it?" I asked, out of politeness. "Oh, it's no book for little girls," she said. She has the silliest voice, a little tinny bleat. She barely bothers to open her mouth. The words just slide through her teeth. In view of what happened later, I put it on record that it was then I first decided that I didn't like her. The men came in then. I noticed she was quick enough to stop reading for them. Father and Simon seemed to be finishing a literary argument. I hoped they'd had a really good discussion downstairs. It was interesting to notice where the men went. Father and the vicar talked to Mrs. Cotton. Aubrey Fox Cotton made a dive for Topaz. Simon and Neil came towards Rose and me, but Mrs. Fox Cotton got off her sofa and intercepted Simon.
"Did you know there's a picture here with a look of you?" she told him, and put her arm through his and marched him along the gallery.
"Oh, I noticed that," I said. Rose and Neil and I walked after them, which I bet didn't please Mrs. F.C. at all. It was one of the earliest pictures, Elizabethan, I think. There was a small white ruff at the top of the man's high collar. It was just a head and shoulders against a dark background.
"It's probably only the beard that's like," said Simon.
No, the eyes, said Mrs. Foxcotton.
The eyebrows mostly, I said. The little twist at the corners. And the hair, the way it grows on the forehead, in a peak.
Rose was staring hard at the picture.
Simon asked her what she thought. She turned and looked at him intently. She seemed to be taking in his features one by one. Yet when she finally answered, she only said,
Oh, a little like, perhaps, rather vaguely.
I had a feeling that she had been thinking about something quite different from the picture, something to do with Simon himself, and had come back from a very long way to find us all waiting for her answer. We strolled back to the others. Topaz and Aubrey Foxcotton were looking at pictures too. They were with the 18th century Cottons.
I've got it, he said suddenly to Topaz. You're really a Blake. Isn't she, Leda?
Mrs. F.C. seemed to take a mild interest in this. She gave Topaz a long appraising stare and said,
Yes. If she had more flesh on her bones.
Rose is a Romney, said Simon. She's quite a bit like Lady Hamilton. It was the first time I'd heard him use her Christian name. And Cassandra's a Reynolds, of course. The little girl with the mousetrap.
I'm not, I said indignantly. I hate that picture. The mouse is terrified, the cat's hungry, and the girl's a cruel little beast. I refuse to be her.
Ah, but you'd let the mouse out of the trap and find a nice dead sardine for the cat, said Simon. I began to like him a little better. The others were busy thinking of a painter for Mrs. Foxcotton. They finally decided on a surrealist named Dali.
With snakes coming out of her ears, said Mr. Foxcotton.
I haven't the faintest idea what surrealism is, but I can easily imagine snakes in Mrs. F.C.'s ears, and I certainly shouldn't blame them for coming out. After that, it was decided that we should dance.
In the hall, said Neil, because the Victrola's down there.
Mrs. Cotton and Father and the vicar stayed behind talking. We shall be one man short, complained Mrs. Foxcotton as we went downstairs. I said I would watch as I don't know modern dances. Neither does Rose, really, but she did try them once or twice at Aunt Millicent's parties.
What kind do you know? Asked Simon teasingly. Sarabands, Courants and Pavans?
I told him just waltzes and polkas. Mother showed us those when we were little.
I'll teach you, said Neil.
He put a record on the gramophone. I had expected the Victrola to be something much more exciting, and then came back to me. But I said I'd rather watch for the first few dances.
Oh, come on, Cassandra, he said.
But Mrs. Foxcotton butted in. Let the child watch if she wants to. Dance this with me. I settled it by running up the stairs. I sat on the top step looking down on them. Rose danced with Simon, Topaz with Mr. Foxcotton. I must say Mrs. Foxcotton danced beautifully, though she seemed almost to be lying on Neil's chest. Rose's dress looked lovely, but she kept on missing steps. Topaz was holding herself stiff as a poker. She thinks modern dancing is vulgar. But Mr. Foxcotton danced so well that she gradually relaxed. It was fascinating watching them all from up there. The hall was very dimly lit. The oak floor looked dark as water by night. I noticed the mysterious old house smell again, but mixed with Mrs. Foxcotton's scent. A rich, mysterious scent. Not a bit like flowers. I leaned against the carved banisters and listened to the music and felt quite different from anywhere I'd ever felt before. Softer. Very beautiful, and as if a great many men were in love with me and I might very easily be in love with them. I had the most curious feeling in my solar plexus. A vulnerable feeling is the nearest I can get to it. I was investigating it in a pleasant, hazy sort of way, staring down at a big bowl of white tulips against the uncurtained great window, when all of a sudden I went quite cold with shock. There were two faces floating in the black glass of the window. The next instant they were gone. I strained my eyes to see them again. The dancers kept passing the window, hiding it from me. Suddenly the faces were back, but grown fainter. They grew clear again, and just then the record finished. The dancers stopped. The faces vanished. Aubrey Foxcotton shouted, "Did you see that, Simon? Two of the villagers staring in again. That's the worst of a right-of-way so close to the house, Simon explained to Rose.
Oh, hell, what does it matter? Said Neil. Let them watch if they want to.
But it startled Mother badly the other night. I think I'll just ask them not to, if I can catch them.
Simon went to the door and opened it. I ran full tilt down the stairs and across to him. There was a light above the door which made everything seem pitch black beyond.
Don't catch them, I whispered.
He smiled down at me in astonishment. Good heavens, I'm not going to hurt them.
He went down the steps and shouted, Anyone there?
There was a stifled laugh quite close. They're behind the cedar, said Simon, and started to walk towards it. I was praying they would bolt, but no sound of it came. I grabbed Simon's arm and whispered, Please come back. Please say you couldn't find them. It's Thomas and Stephen.
Simon let out a snort of laughter.
They must have cycled over, I said. Please don't be annoyed. It's just that they hankered to see the fun.
He called out, Thomas, Stephen, where are you?
Come in and talk to us.
They didn't answer. We walked towards the cedar.
Suddenly they made a dash for it, and Thomas promptly tripped over something and fell full length.
I called, Come on, both of you, it's perfectly all right. Simon went to help Thomas up. I knew he wasn't hurt because he was laughing so much. My eyes were used to the darkness by then, and I could see Stephen some yards away. He had stopped, but he wasn't coming towards us. I went over and took him by the hand.
I'm so dreadfully sorry, he whispered. I know it was a terrible thing to do.
Nonsense, I said. Nobody minds a bit. His hand was quite damp. I was sure he was feeling awful. The others had heard the shouts and come to the door. Neil came running out to us with a torch.
What? My old friend Stephen? He cried. Are there any bears abroad tonight?
I don't want to come in, please,
Stephen whispered to me. But Neil and I took an arm each and made him. Thomas wasn't minding at all. He kept choking with laughter.
We had a squint at you at dinner, he said, and then you all disappeared. We were just about to go home in despair when you came downstairs.
Once I saw Stephen clearly in the hall, I was sorry I had made him come in. He was scarlet to his forehead and too shy to speak a word, and Rose made things worse by saying affectedly, I think it was due to embarrassment.
I do apologize for them. They ought to be ashamed of themselves.
Don't mind your great-aunt Rose, boys, said Neil, with a grin. Come on, we'll go and raid the icebox.
I once saw them do that on the pictures, and it looked marvellous. I thought I would go along too, but Mrs. Foxcotton called me back.
Who's that boy?
The tall, fair one, she demanded.
I told her about Stephen. She said,
I must photograph him.
What, at this time of night?
She gave a whinnying little laugh.
Of course not. You silly child. He must come up to London. I'm a professional photographer. Look here, ask him.
No.
Don't bother.
She ran upstairs. Neil and the boys had disappeared by then. I was sorry because I was quite a bit hungry, in spite of the enormous dinner. I suppose my stomach had got into practice. I feared that if I hung about, Simon might feel he ought to dance with me. He was dancing with Rose again, and I wanted him to go on, so I went upstairs. It was pleasant being by myself in the house. One gets the feel of a house much better alone. I went very slowly, looking at the old prints on the walls of the passages. Everywhere at Scotney one feels so conscious of the past. It's like a presence, a caress in the air. I don't often get that feeling at the castle. Perhaps it has been altered too much, and the oldest part seems so utterly remote. Probably the beautiful, undisturbed furniture helps at Scotney. I expected to hear voices to guide me back to the gallery, but everything was quiet. At last I came to a window open onto the courtyard and leaned out and got my bearings. I could see the gallery windows. I could see the kitchen windows too, and Neil and Thomas and Stephen eating at the table. It did look fun. When I went into the gallery, Father and Mrs. Cotton were at the far end, and the vicar was lying on the sofa by the middle fireplace reading Mrs. Foxcotton's book. I told him about Thomas and Stephen.
"Let's go and talk to them," he said, "unless you want me to dance with you. I dance like an india rubber ball." I said I should like to see the kitchens. He got up, closing the book. Mrs. Foxcotton said that was no book for little girls, I told him.
It's no book for little vicars, he said, chuckling.
He took me down by the back stairs. He knows the house well, as he was very friendly with old Mr. Cotton. It was interesting to notice the difference once we got into the servants' quarters. The carpets were thin and worn. The lighting was harsh. It felt much colder. The smell was different, too. Just as old, but with no mellowness in it. A stale, damp, dispiriting smell. But the kitchens were beautiful when we got to them, all painted white, with a white enamelled stove and the hugest refrigerator. Aunt Millicent only had an old one which dribbled. Neil and the boys were still eating, and sitting on the table, talking hard to Stephen, was Mrs. Foxcotton. As I came in, she was handing him a card. I heard her say, "All you have to do is to give that address to the taxi driver. I'll pay your fare when you get there. Or perhaps I'd better give you some money now." She opened her evening bag. "Are you really going to be photographed?" I asked him. He shook his head and showed me the card. It had "Leader Artist Photographer" on it, under a beautifully drawn little swan, and an address in St. John's Wood. "Be a nice child and help me to persuade him," she said. "He can come on a Sunday. I'll pay his fare and give him 2 guineas. He's exactly what I've been looking for months." "No, thank you, ma'am," said Stephen, very politely. "I'd be embarrassed." "Heavens! What's there to be embarrassed about? I only want to photograph your head. Would you do it for 3 guineas? "What, for just one day?" She gave him a shrewd little look, then said quickly, 5 guineas, if you come next Sunday." "Don't do it if you don't want to, Stephen," I said. He swallowed and thought. At last he said, "I'll have to think it over, ma'am. Would it be 5 guineas if I came a little later?" "Any Sunday you like. I can always use you. Only write in advance to make sure I shall be free. You write for him," she added to me. "He'll write himself if he wants to," I said coldly. She sounded as if she thought he was illiterate. "Well, don't you go putting him off. 5 guineas, Stephen, and I probably won't need you for more than 2 or 3 hours. She grabbed a wing of chicken and sat there gnawing it. Neil offered me some, but my appetite had gone off. Stephen said it was time he and Thomas rode home. Neil asked them to stay on and dance, but didn't press it when he saw Stephen didn't want to. We all went to see them off. The bicycles were somewhere at the back of the house. On the way, we passed through a storeroom where enormous hams were hanging. "Old Mr. Cotton sent us one of those every Christmas," said Thomas. "Only he was dead last Christmas." Neil reached up and took the largest ham off its hook. "There you are, Tommy," he said. "Oh, Thomas, you can't," I began. But I didn't want Neil to call me Great Aunt Cassandra, so I finished up, "Well, I suppose you have." And I certainly would have fainted with despair if Thomas had refused the ham. In the end, I undertook to bring it home because he couldn't manage it on his bicycle. "But swear you won't go all ladylike and leave it behind," he whispered. I swore. After the boys had gone, we went back to the hall and found the others still dancing. "Come on, Cassandra," said Neil, and whirled me off. Dear me, dancing is peculiar when you really think about it. If a man held your hand and put his arm round your waist without its being dancing, it would be most important. In dancing, you don't even notice it. Well, only a little bit. I managed to follow steps better than I expected, but not easily enough to enjoy myself. I was quite glad when the record ended. Neil asked Rose to dance then, and I had a glorious waltz with the vicar. We got so dizzy that we had to flop on a sofa. I don't fancy Rose followed Neil as well as I had done, because as they passed I heard him say, "Don't keep on putting in little fancy steps of your own." I guess that would annoy her, and it did. When the music stopped and he asked her to come out into the garden for some air, she said, "No thanks," almost rudely. After that we all went back to the long gallery, where Father and Mrs. Cotton were talking as hard as ever. Mrs. Cotton broke off politely as we went in, and the conversation was general for a while. But Mrs. Foxcotton kept yawning and patting her mouth and saying, "Excuse me," which only drew more attention to it. And soon Topaz said we ought to be going.
Mrs. Cotton protested, courteously, then rang for the car. There was a late feeling about the evening, just as there used to be at children's parties, the few I ever went to, after the first nurse arrived to take a child home. I picked up the ham as we went through the hall and tactfully kept it under the wrap Topaz had lent me. It was a most peculiar sort of burnous thing, but it came in very useful. Simon and Neil went out to the car with us and said they would come over and see us when they got back from London. They were driving up the next day to stay for a fortnight. And so the party was over. "Great heavens, Cassandra! How did you get that?" said Father, when he saw me nursing the ham. I told him, and explained that I'd been hiding it in case he made me refuse it. "Refuse it? You must be insane, my child." He took it from me to guess how much it weighed. We all guessed, which was a sheer waste of time, as we haven't any scales. "You're nursing it as if it were your first-born child," said Father, when it was returned to me eventually. I said I doubted if anyone's first-born child was ever more welcome. After that, we all fell silent. We had suddenly remembered the chauffeur. Even when we got home, we didn't all rush to compare notes. I got the feeling that we all wanted to do a little private thinking. I certainly did. I began as soon as Rose and I had blown our bedroom candles out. I wasn't a bit sleepy. I went through the whole evening. It was almost nicer than when it was actually happening until I got to the bit in the kitchen with Mrs. Fox Cotton asking Stephen to sit for her. I found I was furious about that. I asked myself why. Why shouldn't he make 5 guineas for a few hours' work? 5 guineas is a tremendous amount of money, and surely a photographer has every right to engage models. I decided I was being most unreasonable, but I went on feeling furious. While I was still arguing with myself, Rose got out of the four-poster and opened the window wider, then sat on the window seat. "Can't you sleep?" I asked. She said she hadn't even been trying, and I guessed she had been going over the evening just as I had. I wished I could change minds with her for a while and relive her evening. I got up and joined her on the window seat. It was such a dark night that I could only see the shape of her. Suddenly she said, "I wish I knew more about men." "Why, especially?" I asked in a quietly encouraging voice. She was silent so long that I thought she wasn't going to answer. Then the words came rushing out. "He's attracted, I know he is. But he's probably been attracted to lots of girls. It doesn't necessarily mean he's going to propose. If only I knew the clever way to behave." I said, "Oh, Rose, have you thought what marriage really means?" "Yes." I thought tonight. When I looked at him to see if he was like that old painting, I suddenly imagined being in bed with him. "What a moment to choose for it. I saw you were pretty preoccupied. Well, how did it feel?" "Most peculiar. But I could face it." "Is it just the money, Rose?" "I'm not sure," she said. "Honestly, I'm not. I don't understand myself. It's terribly exciting feeling men are attracted to you. It's... but you couldn't understand." I think perhaps I could. For a second I thought of telling her about Stephen, but before I could start she went on. "I like him, really I do. He's so courteous. He's the first person who ever made me feel I matter. And he's handsome, in a way, don't you think? His eyes are, anyway. If I could just get used to the beard. Are you sure you wouldn't rather have Neil? He's so very kind and he's got such a nice clean face." "Oh, Neil." Her tone was so scornful that I realized he must have annoyed her even more than I had suspected. "No, you can have Neil." Honestly, that was the first time the idea had ever occurred to me. Of course, I didn't take it seriously. But I felt it deserved a little quiet thinking about. "If only I could get Simon to shave," Rose went on. Then her voice went hard. "Anyway, what does it matter? I'd marry him even if I hated him. Cassandra, did you ever see anything as beautiful as Mrs. Cotton's bathroom?" "Yes, lots of things," I said firmly. "And no bathroom on earth will make up for marrying a bearded man you hate." "But I don't hate him. I tell you, I like him. I almost..." She broke off and went back to bed. "Perhaps you won't be sure of your feelings until you've let him kiss you," I suggested. "But I can't do that before he proposes.
Or he mightn't propose, she said decidedly. That's one thing I do know. I had a strong suspicion she was being a mite old-fashioned, but I kept my views to myself. Well, I shall pray you really fall in love with him, and he with you, of course. And I'll do out-of-bed prayers. So will I, she said, hopping out again. We both prayed hard. Rose much the longest. She was still on her knees when I had settled down ready to sleep. That'll do, Rose, I told her at last. It's enough just to mention things, you know. Long prayers are like nagging. We were restless for ages. I tried to invent something soothing for Miss Blossom to say, but I wasn't in the mood. After a while, I heard an owl hooting and calmed myself by thinking of it flying over the dark fields. And then I remembered it would be pouncing on mice. I love owls, but I wish God had made them vegetarian. Rose kept flinging herself over in bed. Oh, do stop walloping about, I said. You'll break what few springs the four-poster has left. But again and again, as I was dropping off, she did a wallop. God's End church clock struck two before I heard her breathing quietly. Then I got to sleep at last. Chapter 9. It took me 3 days to describe the party at Scotney. I didn't mark the breaks, because I wanted it to seem like one whole chapter. Now that life has become so much more exciting, I think of this journal as a story I'm telling. A new chapter happened yesterday, which I long to dash straight into, but I shall resist the temptation and bring myself up to date first. One temptation I didn't manage to resist was that of letting my imagination leap ahead a bit. As Rose had said I could have Neil, I let myself just toy with the idea. I thought about it when I woke up the day after the party and imagined his proposing. I made it happen in the water garden at Scotney. I accepted him, and Rose and I arranged to have a double wedding, and bought the most superb trousseau. Then I dozed off again, and dreamt I really was married to Neil. We were shut up together in Mrs. Cotton's bathroom in a terribly embarrassing way, and Stephen's face kept floating in the looking-glass walls. I was very glad to wake up and find it wasn't true. Of course, Neil will never propose to me now that I have let myself imagine it. Not that I mind. I suppose he just might, in a completely different way, and not in the water garden. Topaz and I had a good gossip about the party while we made the beds. She was more and more hopeful for Rose, but depressed about Father. He had snubbed her when she asked him what he and Mrs. Cotton had talked about. All I got out of him was, "Don't be a fool, my dear. How can one repeat the details of a conversation? She's a highly intelligent woman, and she can listen as well as she can talk." And then what do you think he said? That he'd placed her wrongly. Her knowledge of literature wasn't at all superficial. She's very widely read. "It just shows," he told me, "that one shouldn't generalize about nations on the strength of a brief acquaintance. And you'd have thought from his tone that I'd been doing the generalizing." "How very annoying," I said, trying not to laugh. I was so tickled that Father had taken to heart Mrs. Cotton's little snub about generalizing. "Anyway, how is it that he can discuss literature with her and not with me? I'm always trying to talk to him about books, but he never lets me." I blame Father for lots of things, but not for that, because it really is agony to talk to her about books. When I was longing for a calm discussion of Tolstoy's War and Peace, she said, "Ah, it's the overlapping dimensions that are so wonderful. I tried to paint it once, on a circular canvas." And then she couldn't remember who Natasha was. I was most sympathetic with her over Father, but rather quick about it, because I wanted to write my journal. I only managed an hour before lunch, but was able to work all afternoon up in the attic. Stephen came to me there when he got back from Four Stones. My heart sank as he held out a folded paper. I had been hoping he had outgrown bringing me poems. He stood waiting for me to read it. After the first line, I realized that it was his own work this time. It was about me, sitting on the stairs at Scotney while the others danced. I was wondering what I could say about it when he snatched it away and tore it up. "I know it's dreadful," he said. I told him it wasn't dreadful at all. "Some of it rhymes splendidly, Stephen, and it's your very own. I like it much better than the ones you copied out." I felt it was an opportunity to stop him copying again. "I didn't exactly copy them," he said, not looking at me.
I always changed words in them. I didn't mean to be dishonest, Cassandra. It was just that nothing of my own seemed good enough. I said I understood perfectly, but he must always write his own poems in future, and I advised him not even to imitate other people's poems. I know you made up every word of this last one, I told him, but it was still a bit like Herrick, all that part about lilies and roses and violets. You didn't really see them in the hall last night. There were only white tulips.
I bet Herrick didn't see all the flowers he wrote about, said Stephen, grinning. And the only rhyme I could find for tulips was blue lips.
I laughed and told him there were more important things than rhymes. Lots of good poetry doesn't have them at all. The main thing is to write what you really feel. Oh, I couldn't do that, he said. No, that would never do.
But why not, Stephen? Of course it would do.
No, it wouldn't, he said, and smiled straight in front of him, as if he were thinking of some private joke. It reminded me of that evening months ago when we were putting saucepans under the drips. He had smiled in just the same private way.
Stephen, I said, do you remember?
Why, it was the very night the Cottons first came here. Do you remember looking out of this window and saying, beginnings are good times? He nodded. But I wasn't expecting any Cottons, he said glumly. Did you dance with them last night?
I tried once with Neil.
People look awful dancing. I'd be ashamed. You'd never do it like that one who calls herself leader, would you?
I'd never dance so well, I said.
But I know what you mean. She does rather drape herself over her partners, doesn't she? You aren't going to let her photograph you, are you? I said it most casually, not as if I minded at all. To my surprise, he put on his wooden look, which is quite different from his daft look. The daft look is hazy, dreamy. The wooden look is obstinate, to the point of sulkiness. It is a look he gives Rose sometimes, but I couldn't remember his ever turning it on me.
I might, he said, if people want to throw their money about.
But surely you'd hate it, Stephen.
It might be worth hating it to earn 5 guineas. 5 guineas would almost be enough. He broke off and turned away to go downstairs.
Enough for what? I called after him.
Oh, for lots of things, he said, without turning round.
5 guineas is more than I can save in a year.
But you were so sure you wouldn't do it last night.
He looked back as he went round the curve of the little attic staircase, his head just above the level of the floor.
Perhaps I will, perhaps I won't, he said maddeningly, and went on down.
A voice in my head said, I'm damned if you're going to sit for Leader Fox Cotton. Then the bell rang for tea, so I followed him down. Topaz had boiled half the ham. She said it would go further if we didn't cut it until it was quite cold, but Thomas insisted. He has been very possessive about that ham. We all fanned it with newspapers until the last moment. It was wonderful, of course. Ham with mustard is a meal of glory. Miss Marcy came after tea to hear all about the party. She told me Mrs. Fox Cotton's photographs are very well known. They get reproduced in magazines. She particularly remembered one of a girl hiding behind a giant shell with the shadow of a man coming towards her. And one got the impression that he was wearing, well, nothing, which surprised me rather because one doesn't often see photographs being as artistic as paintings, does one? But he probably had a bathing suit on all the time. It would hardly show on a shadow, would it? I laughed. I do adore darling Miss Marcy. But I was all the more determined Stephen shouldn't go near the Fox Cotton woman. The next morning, Topaz, Rose and I went into King's Crypt with the £20 the vicar gave for the collie dog rug and bought my first grown-up dress. Pale green linen. Rose had a pink one. Topaz said she didn't need anything herself, and anyway she looks most unnatural in ready-made clothes. I got some white shoes and a pair of practically silk stockings. If anyone asked me to a garden party, I could go. When we got home, we found Father hadn't eaten the lunch Topaz had left for him and wasn't anywhere in the castle. He turned up about 9 o'clock and said he had bicycled over to Scotney. Apparently, Simon had given him the run of the library while they were away.
I asked if he had read anything particularly interesting. "Oh, mostly American magazines and some critical essays," he said. "I'd forgotten how advanced American criticism is."
Topaz said she would get him a meal, but he told her he'd had luncheon and dinner.
"It seems Mrs. Cotton left instructions that I'm to be fed when I go there."
He went off to the gatehouse looking rather smug. I retired to the attic and went on with this journal. When I came down to the kitchen again, Stephen was writing on an opened-out sugar bag. He went scarlet when he saw me and crumpled the sugar bag up. Just then Topaz came in from the garden wearing Aunt Millicent's black cloak and no stockings or shoes. I guessed she'd had one of her nude sessions.
"Thank heaven nature never fails me," she said as she stumped upstairs.
When I turned round, Stephen was poking the sugar bag down into the fire. "Was it another poem?" I asked. I feel I ought to encourage him now he is writing his own poems. "Why did you burn it?"
"Because it wouldn't do at all," he said, still very red in the face. He stared at me for a second, then suddenly dashed out into the garden.
I waited for him, sitting by the fire with Ab and Hell, but he didn't come back. When I went upstairs, Rose was sitting up in bed, varnishing her nails. The varnish had been her special treat out of the vicar's money. I had lavender soap.
"You're using that too soon," I said. "The Cottons won't be back for 12 days yet."
Little did I think we should see them again in only 4. Yesterday was the 1st of May. I love the special days of the year. St. Valentine's, Halloween, Midsummer Eve most of all. A May day that feels as it sounds is rare, and when I leaned out of the bedroom window watching a moat ruffled into sparkles by a warm breeze, I was as happy as I've ever been in my life. I knew it was going to be a lucky day. It certainly made a false start before breakfast. Father came down in his best dark suit that he hasn't worn for years. Rose and I gaped at him, and Topaz stopped stirring the porridge to say, "Mortmain, what on earth?"
"I'm going up to London," said Father shortly.
"What for?"
we all said together, which made it rather loud. "Business," said Father, even louder, and went out of the kitchen, banging the door.
"Don't worry him. Don't ask questions," whispered Topaz.
Then she turned to me, looking miserable.
"Do you think he's going to see her? Mrs. Cotton?"
"Surely he couldn't. Not without being asked," I said.
"Oh, yes, he could," said Rose. "Look at him. Going to Scotney 3 days running, letting the servants feed him, grubbing about in the books and magazines. I tell you, he'll end by putting them off us."
"It wasn't him who put them off us last time," said Topaz angrily. I saw there were going to be high words, so I went through into the drawing room. Father was sitting on the window seat polishing his shoes with the curtain. When he got up, he was covered with Heloise's white hairs from the seat pad.
"Is there no place a man in a dark suit can sit in this house?" he shouted as he went to the hall for the clothes brush.
"Not unless we dye hell black," I said. I brushed him, but what with the brush having lost most of its bristles, his suit having lost most of its nap, and Heloise having lost more hairs than seemed believable, the result was poor. Topaz came to say that breakfast was ready, but he said he would miss his train if he waited for it.
Don't fuss, he said, when she begged him to have just something.
Then he pushed past her in the rudest way and grabbed Rose's bicycle because his own had a flat tire.
"When will you be back?" Topaz called after him.
He yelled over his shoulder that he hadn't the faintest idea.
"What is the matter with him?" said Topaz as we walked back across the garden. "I know he's always been moody, but not bad-tempered like this. It's been getting worse ever since we went to Scotney."
"Perhaps it's better than heavy resignation," I suggested, trying to be comforting. "He was shockingly bad-tempered when we were little, when he was writing. You know about Mother and the cake knife." Topaz looked suddenly hopeful.
"He can massacre me if it'll really help him," she said.
Then the light died out of her eyes.
"But I'm no good to him. It's that woman who started him."
"Gracious, we don't know if anything started him," I said. "We've had so many false alarms. Where did he get the money to go to London?"
She said she had given him £5 of the vicar's rug money, though I didn't think he'd spend it on seeing her. Then she added nobly, I suppose I oughtn't even to mind that if she stimulates him. Rose came out of the kitchen with a slice of bread and jam and passed us without a word. I gathered she and Topaz had had a very sharp row while I was brushing Father. We found that the porridge was burnt, than which there can be few less pleasing forms of food, and what with this and Topaz's mood of gloom, we had a depressing meal. The boys, of course, had gone off earlier, after a hammy breakfast. I shall go and dig, until I find peace, said Topaz, when we had done the washing up and made the beds. I felt she would find it better alone, and I wanted to write in my journal. I had finished the evening at Scotney, but there were some reflections about life I wanted to record. I never did record them, and have now forgotten what they were. As I settled myself down on Belmont Mound, I saw Rose going along the lane with Mrs. Stebbins' crinoline. Stephen had brought word that the old lady was fretting for it. He had refused to take it back for Rose because he said he'd feel embarrassed. Rose had it over her shoulder. She did look peculiar. I decided to think a little before I began writing, and lay back enjoying the heat of the sun and staring up at the great blue bowl of the sky. It was lovely feeling the warm earth under me and the springing grass against the palms of my hands while my mind was drawn upwards. Unfortunately, my thoughts will never stay exalted for very long, and soon I was gloating over my new green dress and wondering if it would suit me to curl my hair. I closed my eyes, as I usually do when I'm thinking very hard. Gradually, I slid into imagining Rose married to Simon. It doesn't seem to matter when you imagine about other people. It only stops things happening when you do it about yourself. I gave Rose a lovely wedding and got to where she was alone with Simon at a Paris hotel. She was a little frightened of him, but I made her enjoy that. He was looking at her the way he did at dinner when he raised his glass to her. I opened my eyes. He was there. The real Simon Cotton, looking at me. I hadn't heard a sound. One second I had seen him in the Paris hotel, brilliantly clear yet somehow tiny and far away, rather as one sees things in a convex mirror. The next instant, he was like a giant against the sky. I had been lying, with the sun on my eyelids, so that for a minute nothing was the right colour. The grass and sky were bleached and his face looked ashen, but his beard was still black. "Did I startle you?" he asked, smiling. I had a bet with myself I'd get up the hill without your hearing. Oh, you weren't asleep, were you? Not quite so early in the day, I said, sitting up, blinking. He sat down beside me. It was the queerest feeling, changing the man I had imagined to the real man. I had made him so fascinating, and of course he isn't really, though very, very nice. I know that now. He and Neil had driven down just for the day. Neil had dropped him at the end of our lane and gone on to Scotney, which sounded as if he weren't very interested in us. "I'm sorry to have missed your sister," said Simon. "But Mrs. Mortmain hopes she'll be back soon." I said I was sure she would, though I really thought she would be gone at least an hour, and wondered if I could be interesting enough to keep him talking as long as that. I asked him if they were having a good time in London. "Oh, yes, I love London. But it seems a waste not to be here in this weather." He leaned back on his elbow, gazing across the fields. I never knew the English spring could be so dazzling. I said it astonished one every year. Well, after next week we'll be back here for some time. That is, Neil and I will. Mother's absorbed in her new apartment. Flat, as I keep forgetting to call it. Leader and Aubrey are helping her to choose the furniture. Oh, that reminds me. He took an envelope from his pocket. I ought to have left this at the castle. It's for that nice boy, Stephen, his fare to London from Leda. I'll give it to him, I said. I wondered if Stephen had written saying he could go, or if she had just sent the money to tempt him. Simon handed me the envelope. Tell me about him, he said. How does he come to speak so differently from the other village boys? Of course, Stephen speaks just as we do, except that he chooses rather humble words. I explained about him. I wonder what he'll make of Leda, said Simon. She wants to pose him with some casts of Greek sculpture. She'll have him in a tunic if he's not careful, or out of it. He certainly has a marvellous head.
Perhaps he'll end up in Hollywood.
I shut the envelope in my journal so that it wouldn't blow away.
What's that? Lessons?
Asked Simon.
Heavens, no. I left school long ago.
I do apologize, he said, laughing. I still think of you as that little girl in the bath.
Is it a story? Read me a bit.
I told him it was my journal, and that I had just finished the party at Scotney. Do I come in it? I'll give you a box of candy, if you'll let me read a page.
All right, I said.
He grabbed the exercise book. After a second or two, he looked up from it. You've swindled me. Is it your own private code?
More or less, though it did begin as real speed writing. It changed by degrees,
and I got it smaller and smaller so as not to waste paper. He turned the pages and guessed a word here and there, but I could see I was safe. After a minute or two, he said, I was reading the journal in Jacob Wrestling again yesterday. I happened to pick up a first edition. It's odd to remember how obscure I found that part when I read it at 16. By the time I came to do it in college, it seemed perfectly intelligible. The only part that still puzzles me is the ladder chapter. You know, where it's printed so that it actually looks like a ladder, with a sentence for every rung. Father won't answer questions about that.
Maybe he can't. I've always believed it's the description of some mystical experience.
Of course, you know the theory that each rung leads to the next, even though the sentences seem so unconnected.
Indeed I don't, I said.
Dear me, it's so extraordinary to hear of people having theories about Father's work and studying it in college thousands of miles away. It must be more important than we realize.
Well, it's one of the forerunners of post-war literature. And your father's a link in the chain of writers who have been obsessed by form. If only he'd carried his methods further.
But didn't you say he couldn't? That Jacob Wrestling was complete in itself, as far as he was concerned, that it couldn't have a successor? He looked at me quickly.
Fancy you remembering that.
Do you know, I'm ashamed to say that didn't mean very much. It was an effort to be tactful when I knew I'd put my foot in it.
I told him I'd guess that, which made him laugh. You nasty noticing child, but I don't think your father spotted me.
And in one way, what I said's true, you know. He can't exactly develop his Jacob Wrestling method because other writers have gone far ahead of him on rather similar lines. James Joyce, for instance. He'd have to take an enormous jump over intervening work, and he hasn't even kept in touch with it. I wonder if that could be what's stopping him writing. That the next rung of the ladder, since we're talking of ladders, has been used by others.
How's that for a theory? Or am I just trying to rationalize my phoniness that first evening?
Well, it's a nice change from the theory that he can't write because he went to jail, I said.
That's fantastic, of course. Why, the reports of the case read like something in Gilbert and Sullivan. And Mother says his description of his life in prison was even funnier.
You mean he actually told her? I gasped. Never have I heard him mention one word about his life in prison.
She asked him point blank. I must say, I wouldn't have dared. She says he looked for a second as if he were going to strike her, and then launched cheerfully into a half-hour monologue. Oh, I'm sure prison isn't the root of the trouble.
I said I'd never believed it myself, but it is queer that he's never written a thing since he came out.
It certainly is. Of course, he ought to be psychoanalyzed.
I suppose no normally intelligent person living in the 1930s can fail to have some faint inkling of what psychoanalysis is, but there are a few things about which I know less. I asked Simon to explain it to me.
Good Lord, that's a tall order, he said, laughing. And I've only the haziest layman's idea of it myself. But let's see now. I think a psychoanalyst would say the trouble lay much further back than those few months in prison, but that prison might have brought it to the surface.
He'd certainly explore that period thoroughly, make your father remember every detail of it.
In a way, he'd have to be put back in prison.
You don't mean physically?
No, of course not.
Though, let me think now, yes, I suppose it's just conceivable that if the trouble did arise in prison, another period of imprisonment might resolve it.
But it's very far-fetched, and quite unworkable anyhow, because if he consented to imprisonment, he wouldn't really feel imprisoned,
and no psychoanalyst would dare to imprison him without his consent. No psychoanalyst would ever get within miles of him. The very mention of psychoanalysis always annoys him. He says it's all rubbish. Well, sometimes it is, said Simon, but not always. The fact that his prejudice against it might be symptomatic. By the way, I suppose you're sure he isn't working on something secretly. I don't see how he could be. We can see right into the gatehouse. There are windows back and front. And he hardly goes near his desk. He just sits reading his old detective stories. He did raise our hopes a few weeks ago. Topaz saw him writing. But it turned out to be a crossword puzzle. He's rather like a detective story himself, said Simon. The case of the buried talent. I wish I could solve it. I'd so much like to write about him. I hadn't known that he wrote. I asked what sort of things. Oh, critical essays, mostly. Just spare time work. I've only had a few things published. Your father'd be a superb subject. If I could find out what monkey wrench got thrown into his works. It would be even better if you could get the monkey wrench out, I said. Well, finding it's the first step. He lay back on the grass with his eyes closed, thinking. I took the opportunity to have a good look at him. It was queer to notice how young his skin looked, contrasted with the beard. I had been liking him better and better all the time we had been talking, and I was planning to tell Rose encouraging things about him. I was glad to see that he has nice ears, because she values good ears. People do look different with their eyes closed. Their features seem so much more sculptured. Simon's mouth is very sculptured. An interesting mouth. I heard myself telling Rose, "Do you know, I think he might be quite an exciting sort of man." Just then he opened his eyes and said, "You don't like it, do you?" I felt myself blushing. "Like what?" I said. "My beard," said Simon. "You were wondering how any man could wear one unless, of course, it has acquired a fascination of horror for you. Which is it?" "As a matter of fact, I'm getting used to it." He laughed and said that was the ultimate humiliation. "Everyone did. Everyone except me," he added. "I never see myself in a glass without feeling astonished." "Would it be rude to ask just why you do wear it?" "It would be natural, anyway. I grew it when I was 22 for a bet, and then kept it out of sheer pig-headedness. It looked so wonderfully unsuitable for a Wall Street office. I was with a cousin of my mother's there, and our dislike was mutual. And I think I felt a beard kept me in touch with literature. But it probably has some deep psychological significance. I expect I'm trying to hide an infamous nature from the world." "Well, it's quite the nicest beard I ever saw," I said. "Do you think you'll ever get rid of it?" For some reason that made him laugh. Then he said, "Oh, in 10 or 12 years, perhaps. Say when I'm 40. It'll be so useful to come down without it one morning, looking 20 years younger. Does your sister hate it?" I wondered if I said yes, whether he would shave it off to please Rose. And I suddenly wasn't sure that I wanted it to go. "You must ask her yourself," I said, laughing. He looked at his watch and said he was afraid he couldn't wait any longer for her. "Neil's picking me up at the God's End Inn at 12:15. Be a nice companionable child and walk to the village with me." He got up and held out his hand to pull me to my feet. Then he looked up at Belmont Tower. "I meant to ask you to show me over that," he said, "but there's no time now. It's more impressive than ever at close quarters." "Have you got used to it belonging to you yet?" I asked. "But it doesn't. Well, not for a little matter of around 30 years. Anyway, it takes me all my time to realize that Scotney does." As we walked down the mound, I told him how I had imagined his first glimpse of Scotney, that night back in March. "Large as it is, it had shrunk," he said.
"Do you mean you'd seen it before?"
"Oh, yes, when I was 7. Father brought me over with him when he patched up the row with my grandfather, which unfortunately broke out again when Father became an American citizen." "Did you know Scotney was going to be yours then?"
"Good Lord, no. There were 6 lives between me and it, and I loved it with a most precocious passion. I remember standing at the top of the staircase looking down on my grandfather, my father, and uncles, and a cousin of my own age, all at tea in the hall, and thinking, if they were all dead, Skotny would belong to me. And then rushing, screaming to the nursery, appalled at my wickedness. I sometimes think I ill-wished all my relations then. It'd be a powerful lot of ill-wishing for a child of 7, I said. I tried to imagine him, very small and dark, on the Skotny stairs where I sat watching the dancing. My grandfather called me the Little Yankee, which infuriated me, but I thought he was wonderful. I wish I could have seen him again before he died. Perhaps I oughtn't to have waited until he agreed to it, but I didn't like to force myself on him. Then he told me that the position had been particularly difficult because he had never been sure if old Mr. Cotton would leave him enough money to keep Skotny up. The estate is entailed, but the money isn't, and without it Simon would just have had to lease the house and stay in America. It must have been very mixing for you, I said, not knowing whether to settle down there or fix your mind on England. You're dead right it was mixing. Sometimes I think I shall never get unmixed. Oh, I shall strike roots here eventually, I guess. But I wish I could have known when I stood on those stairs. We had come to the stile leading to the lane. He sat on the top rail for a moment, looking at the barn. That's magnificent, he said. Wonderful old timbers. Oughtn't I to repair the roof? I'd like to be a good landlord. I said that was our job, as we have the castle on a repairing lease. Then we caught each other's eyes and burst out laughing. You won't count on us doing it this year, I added. He helped me over the stile, still laughing. Then he said, Listen, Cassandra, there's something I want your father to know, and I don't like to tell him myself. Can you make him understand that I don't mind at all about the rent? That I shall never mind, even if he doesn't pay a cent for the rest of his lease? I'd like him to know that I'm honored to feel he's my tenant. I'd call him more of a guest than a tenant, I said, and we both laughed again. Then I thanked him and promised to tell Father. Do it tactfully, won't you? Don't let me sound gracious and patronizing. But I do think you're gracious. The right kind of gracious. There's a right kind of patronage, too, you know. Perhaps Father'll dedicate his next book to you as its only begetter. What a nice child you are, he said quietly. Not too consciously naive. I swear that I said it without thinking. It just leapt from my mouth. It was looking at the barn that did it. While we talked, I had been remembering that day, gloating over the way things had changed. His head jerked round. What do you mean? Oh, nothing in particular, I said lamely. I dare say some people think I am. We were passing the barn. And that minute, Heloise put her head out from where I sat listening that day and let forth a volley of barks. She takes naps on the chaff with one ear well open for rats. Were you up there? Said Simon. I nodded. We were both of us very red. How much did you hear? Just that about me. Heloise came dashing out of the barn, still barking, which I hoped would mean the end of the subject, and stooping to pat her was a good way to avoid his eyes. But she instantly stopped barking, and then he bent down and patted her too, looking at me across her. I'm so terribly ashamed of myself, he said. I apologize most abjectly. Nonsense! It did me a lot of good, I told him. That wasn't all you heard, was it? Did you hear? I didn't let him finish. Come on, we'll be late for your brother, I said. Just let me get rid of my journal. I ran off and put it in the barn, taking my time over it, and I talked very determinedly about the weather as I rejoined him. It's the loveliest 1st of May I ever remember, I said, and then made rather a business of calling for Heloise, who had disappeared. She put her head out of the frothy cow parsley looking like a bride. The country's all dressed in white lace, I said as we walked down the lane. He was silent so long that I thought he hadn't heard me. Then suddenly he said, What? Oh, yes, sorry. I was trying to remember what you could have heard me say about Rose. I tried to think of the most convincing way to reassure him. Well, whatever it was, she doesn't know it, I said at last. I am an honest liar when I take my time. He believed me at once. You wonderful child, not to tell her. I heard myself explaining to God, as I always do about good, kind, useful lies.